This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Rebecca Dittman, Liverpool, United Kingdom. Web address, mercurialspirit.co.uk. From October to Brest-Litovsk, by Leon Trotsky. Chapter 21, Internal Friction. In the meantime, the struggle for Soviet control spread all over the country. In Moscow especially, this struggle took on an extremely protracted and bloody character. Perhaps not the least important cause of this was the fact that the leaders of the revolt did not at once show the necessary determination in attacking. In civil war, more than in any other, victory can be ensured only by a determined and persistent course. There must be no vacillation. To engage in parleys is dangerous. Merely to mark time is suicidal. We are dealing here with the masses, who have never held any power in their hands, who are therefore most wanting in political self-confidence. Any hesitation at revolutionary headquarters demoralizes them immediately. It is only when a revolutionary party steadily and resolutely makes for its goal that it can help the toilers to overcome their century-old instincts of slavery and lead them on to victory. And only by these means of aggressive charges can victory be achieved with the smallest expenditure of energy and the least number of sacrifices. But the great difficulty is to acquire such firm and positive tactics. The people's want of confidence in their own power and their lack of political experience are naturally reflected in their leaders, who, in their turn, find themselves subjected, besides, to the tremendous pressure of bourgeois public opinion from above. The liberal bourgeoisie, treated with contempt and indignation the mere idea of the possibility of a working-class government, and gave free vent to their feelings on the subject in the innumerable organs at their disposal. Close behind them trailed the intellectuals, who, with all their professions of radicalism and all the socialistic coating of their world philosophy, are, in the depths of their hearts, completely steeped in slavish worship of bourgeois strength and administrative ability. All these socialistic intellectuals hastily joined the right and considered the ever-increasing strength of the Soviet government as the clear beginning of the end. After the representatives of the liberal professions came the petty officials, the administrative technicians, all those elements which materially and spiritually subsist on the crumbs that fall from the bourgeois table. The opposition of these elements was chiefly passive in character, especially after the crushing of the cadet insurrection. But nevertheless, it might still seem formidable. We were being denied cooperation at every step. The government officials would either leave the ministry or refuse to work while remaining in it. They would turn over neither the business of the department nor its money accounts. The telephone operators refused to connect us, while our messages were held up or distorted in the telegraph offices. We could not get translators, stenographers, or even copyists. All this could not fail to create such an atmosphere as led various elements in the higher ranks of our own party to doubt whether, in the face of a boycott by bourgeois society, the toilers could manage to put the machinery of government in working order and continue in power. Opinions were voiced as to the necessity of coalition. Coalition with whom? With the liberal bourgeoisie? But an attempt at coalition with them had driven the revolution into a terrible morass. The revolt of the 25th of October was an act of self-preservation on the part of the masses after the period of impotence and treason of the leaders of coalition government. There remained for us only coalition in the ranks of so-called revolutionary democracy, that is, coalition of all the Soviet parties. Such a coalition we did, in fact, propose from the very beginning, at the session of the Second All-Russian Council of Soviets on the 25th of October. The Kerensky government had been overthrown, and we suggested that the Council of Soviets take the government into its own hands. But the right parties withdrew, slamming the door after them, and this was the best thing they could have done. They represented an insignificant section of the council. They no longer had any following in the masses, and those classes which were still supported out of mere inertia were coming over to our side more and more. Coalition with the right social revolutionists and the Mensheviki could not broaden the social basis of the Soviet government, and would, at the same time, introduce into the composition of this government elements which were completely disintegrated by political scepticism and idolatry of the liberal bourgeoisie. The whole strength of the new government lay in the radicalism of its programme and the boldness of its actions. To tie itself up with Chernofi and Tereselli factions would mean to bind the new government hand and foot, to deprive it of freedom of action and thereby forfeit the confidence of the masses in the shortest possible time. Our nearest political neighbours to the right were the so-called left social revolutionists. They were, in general, quite ready to support us, but endeavoured nevertheless to form a coalition socialist government. The management of the railroad union, the so-called Viksal, the Central Committee of the Postal Telegraph Employees and the Union of Government Officials were all against us, and in the higher circles of our own party, voices were being raised as to the necessity of reaching an understanding with these organisations one way or another. But on what basis? All the above-mentioned controlling organisations of the old period had outlived their usefulness. They bore approximately the same relation to the entire lower personnel as did the old army committees to the masses of soldiers in the trenches. History had created a big gulf between the higher classes and the lower. Unprincipled combinations of these leaders of another day, leaders made antiquated by the revolution, were doomed to inevitable failure. It was necessary to depend wholly and confidently upon the masses in order, jointly with them, to overcome the sabotage and the aristocratic pretensions of the upper classes. We left it to the left social revolutionists to continue the hopeless efforts for coalition. Our policy was, on the contrary, to line up the toiling lower classes against the representatives of organisations which supported the Kerensky regime. This uncompromising policy caused considerable friction and even division in the upper circles of our party. In the Central Executive Committee, the left social revolutionists protested against the severity of our measures and insisted upon the necessity for compromises. They met with support on the part of some of the Bolsheviki. Three people's commissaries gave up their portfolios and left the government. A few other party leaders sided with them in principle. This created a very deep impression in intellectual and bourgeois circles. If the Bolsheviki could not be defeated by the cadets and Krasnov's Cossacks, thought they, it is quite clear that the Soviet government must now perish as a result of internal dissension. However, the masses never noticed this dissension at all. They unanimously supported the Soviet of People's Commissaries, not only against counter-revolutionary instigators and sabotagers, but also against the coalitionists and the sceptics. End of chapter 21.